You're listening to Well Made, a podcast from Lumi about the people and ideas behind your favorite online brands. I'm your host, Stefan Ango. Carrie Cooper, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So you are the president and COO of Rothy's. I think people will be familiar with Rothy's. You're making a wonderful women's and now kids shoe that is made out of recycled plastic bottles. How do you describe Rothy's these days?
I think, mostly it's a chic shoe for a woman who wants to look put together day to night that is, made sustainably in every way and is super comfortable.
How do you define chic? What's the 2019 version of chic?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know if I'm hip enough for that, but I think, there's sort of a modern, the modern woman, whether she's in Shanghai or San Francisco or London, she's busy all day and she wants to look put together, whether she's in the boardroom or the soccer field. Mm. And I think there's a lot of us have gone through the world of like the shoe shuffle, right? Of like, okay, well, I can wear this shoe that's comfortable to commute in, and then I have to have this shoe in the office, and then I have to have this shoe for dinner, and that should be the same shoe. Like there's too much like brain power wasted on thinking about what you're going to wear.
Yeah, so it's a flat. It's not a heel. It's very comfortable to wear. Mm-hmm. People are. I see my co-founder Jessie running around in them. She wears the one with the what is it? The top. What am I talking about?
The flat or the point?
Yeah, the flat, I think.
So we have five different, four different silhouettes. We have the flat and the point, which are the two we launched with. We launched the loafer last year in May, and then we launched the sneaker in September. And we launched kids. First, we started with the girls' loafer, and then we launched kids in March. So I guess it's six silhouettes at this point.
I'm pulling it up. It's the sneaker.
The sneaker.
Jessie is a sneaker Rothy's. I see her running around. She's a very fast walker for her size, mm-hmm. and people can't keep up with her when she's wearing Rothy's. So it works, and she looks good.
They're comfortable no matter what time, where you're wearing them. I wear them all day standing. It's great.
So you got involved in 2018, like mm-hmm. just over a year ago. Mm-hmm. Company's been around now for what, three, 4 years?
More like six or seven.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh my God. It's been that long?
Stephen Roth spent 4.5 years on R&D and figuring out how to do this, which is just more entrepreneurial than I think a lot of people even think to do. And maybe it's stubborn. Maybe it's whatever it might be. I'm going to figure out how to do this well.
Okay. So there were a few years there of R&D and then the brand officially launched when?
They officially launched, I think, in late 2015. They got the shoe out and they realized they had a fit issue. And so they kind of put a pause on it. And then I think it officially launched July 2016.
Wow.
I guess that's the question of it depends on how you answer that question. So from July 2016, it's been 2.5 years of consistent sales. Part of figuring out how to do this shoe well, the fit is hard.
Yeah.
When you're knitting a product, if you're knitting a sweater, half an inch doesn't even really matter. On a sleeve length, you wouldn't notice it. But 3 millimeters on a shoe is half a size. Mm. And so the precision of how do I get this shoe to fit to size the way I want it to fit has been really, that was the biggest challenge, I think, that they had to get through.
Got it. Yeah, it looks really cool. And we'll put photos in the show notes. And the knit aspect is important. So I'm guessing, I wasn't even really thinking about that aspect. I was thinking what were they doing for a couple years doing this R&D? Was it, I guess it's a combination of that plus the material science of actually developing mm-hmm. this material that's recycled. What was involved in all of the R&D?
The inspiration from it came from their wives, right? Of watching Lululemon had taken off in the marina and there were lots of women wearing, how do I look put together? Not a clunky sneaker is probably not what looks great with leggings. And what do I do to transition? So they wanted to go after the ballet flat and how do we do that well? So they went to China first and tried to figure out how shoe manufacturing happened. I mean, Stephen came from investment banking. Roth built one of the largest art galleries on the West Coast. They came from very, very different backgrounds, neither of them in shoes.
And neither they had to, of them learn. Wearing women's shoes
right,
for the
totally.
Most part.
Yep, for sure. How do we make this work? So they went and learned how does it work there. And then they thought they could do it on shore. So they bought a factory in Maine.
Wow.
Tried to build it in Maine. They spent a year and a half trying to make it work in Maine. So in Lewiston, Maine, which is where L.L. Bean still makes duck boots and military boots are still made there. So the last bastion of U.S. manufacturing there. And they just couldn't get it to work. They couldn't get the supply chain to work. They couldn't get... one 20-cent piece messed up, kind of everything on Made in America. There was a British company that closed their factory in the U.S. And so suddenly that 20-cent part made it not Made in America.
Wow.
And Roth kind of picked up and moved back to China for 2 years to figure out how to make this thing work and how to get the knitting to happen and how to get the assembly to happen the right way. And that was sort of the longest part of the R&D is like, how do I get this shoe to be built? And how, you know, that's where like I have more of so much respect for how long and how hard it was to go through that and maybe how stubborn they are that they're going to figure out how to make it work. Cause it's kind of a novel idea of how do I knit a shoe?
And at this point, just to give people a sense of scale, the company has sold over 1 million pairs of shoes. The part that's even more impressive to me is it's 27 million bottles that have been turned into shoes over the course of the past 3 years or something like that. Mm-hmm. So this is going to get extremely nerdy because, well, by the time this airs, it will be like Earth
past
Day.
28, yeah.
No, it will be Earth Day. And like we go nuts every year on Earth Day. We just call it Earth Week. It's like we just have so many blog posts and different things coming out. And one of the articles that we're working on right now is kind of breaking down what's happening with China and recycling. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder, they have put on, you know, some really serious bans on paper recycling as well as plastic and not accepting recycled material from other countries. Is that affecting in any way the supply chain of Rothy's?
No, we worked with an American supplier to create the yarn. Hmm. And part of what China doesn't want is really dirty recycling. So a lot of the problems in the U.S. recycling system is the mix of dirty product that and so it requires hand labor to separate it. So we are taking American recycled products and sending them over in pellets. So that's
already pelletized?
It's already pelletized.
Oh, wow.
So it's clean and so it doesn't cut down. It doesn't create a problem for us on, they're willing to import clean,
right,
you
sure.
know, clean broken down product is great.
And so where did this plastic come from? Is it just from like the normal recycling mm-hmm. system in America?
I mean, the sad part about plastic water bottles or plastic bottles, I should sort of more generally, so it's made of PET. Mm-hmm. 9% of it's recycled. 12% is incinerated and 80% goes to landfill.
Wow.
We have an infinite supply, unfortunately.
Mm. So does that make it easy to buy from your perspective? Is that like a cost advantage that you have compared to like making something out of cotton or something else?
No, I think, I don't know for sure. I'm 95% sure you could actually make them cheaper if you bought, if you did primary versus recycled. Mm-hmm. There's an extra
like
expense in taking. If you did virgin plastic, you'd make it cheaper. But that's not what we want to do. Mm. Like, you know, sort of the entire goal of what we have is sustainability at our core and how do we cut waste out of the system? And waste comes in lots of ways. I mean, waste is, I think the biggest thing for apparel, it's overproduction, right? Mm. So I think if you go back to sort of, you know, Burberry burning clothes or, you know, the markdowns that happen like that, that's sort of the number one problem. And by owning our own factory, we control that. And then how you make the product. So these are knit. So a normal shoe, you're cutting a circle out of a square. And so you waste 30% of the leather or the canvas or whatever the material is, you're making it. And we're knitting it to shape. So we have no waste other than just the thread that comes off the knitting machine, which we also recycle. And then it's made from, everything we have is from recycled products. So there's, you know, sustainability is sort of at our core of everything that we're doing. And like, we continue to like want to innovate. How do we make this better? How can we cut down? You know, our boxes are, we ship the shoes in a box that's meant to be shipped versus a box in a box.
Right.
It's
that
all
seems
that box. What?
No, I mean for.
It does, right? And then like you look at the world of like Amazon boxes, right? Where there's like boxes and boxes with plastic inside. And it's just infuriating of like we as a country and as a world could figure out how to do this in a better way.
I didn't mean it's obvious in the sense that, you know, everyone's doing it already. I just mean it seems logical.
Right.
and it's like advice that we get, again, going back to like Earth Day stuff. Like we have an article coming out that is basically just number one tip. Use less packaging. Like people ask us.
Carry a water bottle with you.
Yeah.
Carry a hydro flask with you.
Yeah.
It can have hot stuff. It can have cold stuff. Like don't use, you know, single use items. Single use plastic is the worst thing we can do in the world.
One of the things I've been obsessed by ever since we had Ryan Babenzien. I don't know if you know him. He's the founder of Greats, another shoe brand. And we were talking about the idea of cost per wear. How much does it cost if you buy a product, not just a shoe, but any sort of thing that's wearable, you know, how much use do you get out of it? And how is that different if you buy a cheap product versus a more expensive product? We haven't mentioned like what, you know, what is the average price of a pair of Rothy's? And you know, is that a measurement that you think about at all?
I think I'd look at that a couple ways. So yes, it's absolutely a considered purchase. It's not a cheap product. So our point is $145. The loafer is $165. The flat and the sneaker $125. So it's not a small amount versus a Chanel or a Prada shoe. It's cheap versus a Skechers $25 Target Walmart shoe. It's expensive. Mm-hmm. But they are durable. They're machine washable. They are, you know, on a cost per wear basis, this shoe, you know, it's durable and going to last a long, long time. It's resaleable also, which is the other interesting part of, like, as we think about the apparel economy, how you think about resale is interesting. Mm. You see a lot of these shoes, like the, you know, there are addicts who want, like, I'm determined I'm going to go get X shoe, and they'll pay, you know, I think the Inverse Stripe sold for almost $1,000 on eBay.
And
which is crazy.
It's because it's limited production? Mm-hmm. Okay.
We make small lots of each product. And so, I mean, obviously a black point is a black point. It's a black point. We will always be in stock in that shoe. But there are other colors that will, you know, we'll see what happens. We'll see what response is to the demand. And, you know, sometimes it sells out really quickly.
I want to talk a little bit about your background before getting involved in Rothy's. But before we go into that, you've been there for just over a year. How did you get involved? Like, did you find out about it and saw, here's a job opening? Or did they come to you? How did it all happen?
I don't think jobs ever come that way in the real world. Jeremy Liu from Lightspeed invested in Rothy's in May of 2017. Sorry, I could make sure my years are right. and Jeremy and I met when I raised money at ModCloth. Mm-hmm. And so he had reached out to me after he invested and said, hey, will you go meet Roth and Steven? And I had just sold my last company and I was still trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And then he pinged me again in October. He's like, seriously, will you come meet Roth and Steven? And so I think I was a little hesitant of two men running a women's shoe company. And I got to meet them and I was like, you know, you don't need me, right? Like they had 20 people in the company. They were looking for a CMO. I had been CEO of my last company and it wasn't, you know, I don't think you need me, but I told them I'd give them half my time. And so in that kind of 2 months that I spent consulting there, helping them, neither of them ever built a business, right? So I have built lots of businesses and structure. Like I love building teams. Mm. So I kept interviewing for other big jobs and I was like, I have a job I love. What am I doing? So I joined officially in February.
And so what was it, I mean, aside from just meeting them, that got you excited about really becoming part of the team?
I think first and foremost, the culture that they, you know, culture comes from founders in a big way. I think they think about sustainability sort of in a broad way of like, this is a place that we all want to, I want you to come to work and I want this to last 20 years. Mm-hmm. So we built a company where, you know, it's a fun place to be. And it's, you know, if you need to go home because you need to go take the kids to soccer practice or whatever, that, you know, we'll make that work. And I think in Silicon Valley, that's a little bit unusual where there's a little bit of a strong man culture of who can stay latest and we've got to go, you know, got to go work 27 hours a day to make it work. So I think that, like, I loved the culture of the team. There is nothing more fun than having a product that everybody loves. Like this product is so loved. It makes it really fun from a marketing and from building the company perspective of having people stop you on the street and ask you about like, oh, are those Rothy's? And, you know, tell me about them. And are they as comfortable as people say they are? Like it's such a viral product. It's really fun to have that as something that you're building. And I think at its core, sustainable, like everything we're doing, like I could sell more big screen TVs or more denim, but at the end of the day, it's still more of that. And this is one where I feel like it's making, you know, we're making a dent in the world in a way that I'm really proud of. So I think it matters to me that like sort of what the legacy you leave behind might be. And this is a great legacy.
Talk about, you said this is a company they're trying to build or you're all trying to build for the next 20 years. That's something that has come up quite a bit on the podcast recently. And I think especially just in kind of the overall mood of direct-to-consumer right now, there's a lot of companies, there's a lot getting sold, a lot getting shut down, there's a lot starting up every day, there's a lot of investment dollars happening in this space. I think it's refreshing to hear people talk about, you know, what is the impact of this company, what is the purpose of this company over the course of, you know, at least our lifetime or maybe more. I don't know, where did that come from and how does that affect like the day-to-day culture of Rothy's?
Well, I think there are, as in any part of Silicon Valley, there's always some like exceptions to the rule, right? So whether it's like Dollar Shave Club that, you know, sort of built itself in, I think, in 18 months and sold for $1 billion, like, you know, more power to them of what they were able to do. Or, you know, I have some that I really admire that didn't raise very much money but have managed to do a nice job and an exit. So I think RX Bar sold for $800 million and they had raised, I don't know, 20 or 30,000. Like, it's impressive to build a brand that way.
Right.
But ultimately, I think I love this technology. I love what we can do. I want to think about what else there is to go do with it. Like I'm not, I love small companies. I've been, obviously I started, you know, I've been at Fortune One. I've been at tiny, tiny nothing. I want to see this thing continue to grow. Like I don't, I hope this lasts for 20 years. Like I hope that we can continue to experiment and learn about who our customer is and what's important and how do you continue to create other products that are sustainable in her life that make her life better.
What are the kinds of decisions that you make or don't make because you want to be around longer?
Well, I think maybe at its heart, it's also profitable, right? Mm-hmm. So one of the lessons I learned from ModCloth is we probably raised too much money. We raised a lot of money and it puts you on a treadmill that where other people are expecting what an exit might look like and how fast that has to happen. And I think you have a risk of losing your brand because you start to go after like how fast can I get growth to happen and how much you know, marketing am I going to spend to go get the next customer? And that's just not a healthy business. Like I think, you know, ultimately like we are EBITDA and cash flow positive and have been since inception. Mm-hmm. And that changes everything. I mean, I hear others say they would open 200 stores and I can't imagine how you would do that in a way that's going to last in the long run because you're going to sign crummy leases. Like I want to build a company where like we're thoughtful about, you know, maybe you sign 10 leases a year, maybe you sign five, but it's hard to imagine you could do 50 profitably. You could do 200 at all.
Yeah, and you mentioned with ModCloth raising too much. What is raising too much? Is that relative? Is that what is too much? Is it when you start to lose control of the company? Is it when you just have so much money that you're making the wrong kinds of decisions? Like, how do you know you've raised too much?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's hindsight's 20/20. You know, when ModCloth was founded, Magento didn't exist. There was no Shopify. It's easy
this
to say in hindsight.
This was 2009?
Well, no, I was there. I think it was founded in 08, 09. So they built it from scratch. So we had like hand-built systems. And so that requires engineers and engineers are expensive, right? So you start to like come on this, like we raised money like a software company. And so we invested as if we were a software company. I think at our peak, we probably had 80 engineers.
Wow.
And that's hard. Like, you know, ultimately we're a dresses company. Like we were a great dress brand. Like we were a great dress brand for everybody. But when you raise that much money and you're investing it in technology, it's hard to imagine like how that payback happens in a very clear ROI driven view. Mm. You know, I see a lot of my peers raising a lot of money. So I guess I'm a little hesitant to say they've raised too much because maybe I'm wrong. Like maybe raising $80 or $100 million is the right answer for the business to build.
What is too much to you? I mean, I guess it's like, it's all relative, right? Mm-hmm. If you're the type of person who wants to build a company and sell it in 2 years, then hey, you accomplished your mission in life. But for you personally, how do you feel about that? Or not about that, like how do you feel about what it means to you to raise too much?
Well, I guess the question is like, what are you going to get out of the investment? So I should believe that a healthy business could spit off enough that you continue to use the profits from the company to invest in where else you want to go. There may be reasons to raise money to get strategic help, right? So if you wanted to enter Asia, for example, maybe given the economic structure in Asia, having Asian investors would help you. Mm-hmm. I would argue that probably is true. Whether you raise 5 million or 50 million, I think is a question of like, what do you really need if you're profitable and how fast do you want to grow? Do I need to open 1,000 stores or do I need to open, you know, like there's a pace of growth question. I think that ultimately I think in any startup you build, there's a question of like, what's the revenue growth and what's the profit growth? And I think there's always just a tension there, right? Of like how fast do you grow revenue and does profit matter? And what's that line look like? And if the less profit matters, the more money you raise.
You talked about being at Fortune One, which I had never heard that term before. But I guess talk to us about Walmart and being at Walmart. I'm so surprised and amazed that you were able to like come from that and then go build, you know, several startups afterwards, because I feel like it must shape you in some ways and maybe in good ways and bad ways. What was it like working there? This was 2008 or so. It's hard for me to like contextualize that because you were working on the e-commerce side and that's obviously like there's always the looming like Amazon giant. And even at that point, they were growing so fast and were kind of like, you know, being probably seen as like the main company where Walmart was like maybe behind in that respect. Like, what was it? Take me back to that time. What was it like being at Walmart? How did you get involved? What were people talking about around the company at that time?
I think 08 was such a tumultuous year in general because the economy just fell apart. So I had left Levi's, and I think, you know, my friend that brought me in. She's like, you can change the world in three ways. You can change the world through the government, the military, or Walmart.
Okay.
And there's got to be some truth to 85% of America lives within 5 miles of a Walmart.
Yeah.
Like the reach and the number, you know, 150 million people going through the store every week. It's an incredible sense of scale that you just can't get in any startup ever, right? Mm. There's just a view there of like, you know, how do you make that work? And so I ran strategy and biz dev. There was both a, how do we grow? And like, do we want to acquire companies? Who do we want to partner with? And obviously with the economy falling apart, we were in a buyer's market. Mm-hmm. I think what I've seen in the last, because it's been almost 10 years or more than 10 years since 08, the board has changed very quickly there of like how willing and eager they are to see, you know, the Jet acquisition clearly has changed dramatically right. What Walmart is. I will tell you, like, I love the company. I think Walmart is a very well-run company. I think it is really hard to be the largest private employer in the world and do it well.
How many people is it at Walmart? It's
they have a million and a half. Yeah.
Right. Cause all it's in not just America. Oh, that's just America.
Yes.
Wow.
So yeah, and it is it's hard to fathom that, right? And so yeah. I think, you know, I remember, you know, I'm pretty liberal, and when I started, the then CEO of Walmart.com said, well, you know, when you employ the number of people the size of the city of San Antonio, something bad is going to happen somewhere.
Every single day,
but it doesn't mean that the San Antonio is bad. And it's sort of a good analogy to me to think about, like, sure, it doesn't mean there's systemic issues. And the company is one where more than anywhere I had ever been to that point was servant led. Of, you know, and servant leadership is your job as a leader is to help the people below you, you know, with whatever obstacles they're hitting, and all blame goes uphill and all praise goes downhill. And it's such a healthy place to be. You know, an officer's meeting, if anyone ever bragged about how good things were going, they would just get their, you know, their head taken off of, no, what did you learn from it? What else is next? What are you going to do better next time? It's such a nice place to be as a leader where you know, you're accountable to helping your teams. So again, I'm a super fan of like what Walmart is doing generally. I think it is really challenging to have a competitor like Amazon that has a profit pool of all the other places where like you're competing with them. So they have AWS, they have, right. I mean, they have built so many businesses that continue, like if, you know, and Jeff Bezos ran that company to earn a penny of profit, right? He wasn't trying to get, like, you know, for many, many, many years, you know, any kind of serious profit. He was investing everything back in the business, and that wasn't what we were held to. So it creates a different structure of what you are. I still think that Walmart has, given the store structure they have and the grocery dominance they have, like a very interesting chance. It's hard.
What was like the motive? Like, what was your mission there? What were you trying to do?
I think, ultimately growing Walmart.com as fast as we could, right? But we were still held to a P&L.
Right.
So I built Marketplace, which is our first ability to let third-party sellers sell in Walmart.
Wow.
And that was a challenge. Like, you know, it's a challenge with the Bentonville merchants to figure out, like, you know, is it okay to have somebody competing with you? I built Pickup Today, which is the ability to buy in-store inventory online. And that is like such a cross-functional. I think I went to Bentonville 30 times in 3 years of, you know, learning, you know, who all the, you know, you have to get the store people and the POS and you have to get, you know, the merchants. There's a huge alignment of how do you get all this to happen. And that's a huge business today. Like, you know, it's a significant part of the Walmart.com business slash the even Walmart business, the ability to go, you know, I want a big screen TV. I just want to make it easy for me to get it. But I don't know that I feel the ownership of it in the same way I do at a startup. I think, you know, it's a huge and a product I'm really proud of that I was part of building, but I was part of building as an architect versus like feeling the ownership in the same way that a startup has.
So you went to ModCloth and then left there. A few years later, Walmart acquires ModCloth. How did that make you feel when you learned about that?
That was the craziest thing ever. Like, the ModCloth brand was so not what I would have expected Walmart to ever be part of. But, you know, I sort of had a little bit of an inside view of what was going on at ModCloth, and it wasn't good. I mean, okay. I'm very happy that the brand lives on. I think they were going to be challenged to make payroll. So I'm happy to see that happened. I think A, I'm glad to see the brand live on. B, the team that's running it has a lot of autonomy now and a balance sheet behind it that they didn't have when we were private. And I'm happy. Like Antonio Nieves, who is the CEO there now, I worked with it when he was running finance at ModCloth. He's great. Like, yeah. I'm happy to see that brand live on. I think from a customer perspective, there's huge backlash. You know, the social, ModCloth was such a social brand. The social backlash was pretty brutal for some period of time. I don't know how long it lasted. I think it goes away. My husband, you would imagine my husband would know these things. I think a year after they bought Bonobos, he was like, did you know Bonobos was owned by Walmart?
Right.
Like,
well, there's always like a certain percentage of the super fans who are going to like be really invested. And that, I mean, the super fans, or, you know, the super users, those are a lot of the people who are driving the momentum. And so if they're not, even if the trickle down effect is like years later, people are like, oh yeah, I guess that's that. And there's stuff like that. Like Amazon owns like so many weird properties of like Amazon owns IMDb, and Goodreads and all these like weird little content sites. And it's just like that always, I always forget that.
But they have a great balance sheet behind them. It gives them like all kinds of cool flexibility to build a brand in a way that like as a startup you don't have, which is kind of cool.
So Bonobos and Andy Dunn, the CEO, is now involved in like strategic acquisitions. Obviously, they acquired Jet.com and Mark Lurie is like running the show. And so their strategy seems to have been, you know, go and build a portfolio, try and build some of your own brands in-house. Like, what is your take on like what's happening over there at the moment? Like, do you feel like it makes sense just looking at it from the outside?
Yeah, I'm so far away at this point. Yeah. Like, like most of my team that I left at Walmart is no longer there. So that caveat. So now I'm just giving this total outsider. Like, yeah. I have no opinion other than, you know, as an outsider. I think they need to make investment. Like, these investments are interesting. They're an interesting shift to, like, how do you change culture in a big company like Walmart? Like, what are the things you're going to do? It appears from the outside they're running those companies independently. Hmm. Like, they're not over-Walmartizing them, which I think is a good sign for building those brands. You know, pickup today with grocery has been really interesting. I think it started in, you know, a third of the stores and it's going to continue to grow. I think, again, like they have this incredible advantage of being really close to 85% of America. And like, it's funny, like I think when I was running strategy and biz dev, how do we bring online into store? And like, there is no, online is dumb. Like, is online a phone? Like, you know, online is there's no online anymore. But how do you just make it easy to shop? I think I see them making great progress there. And I think, you know, at its core, again, like I'm a Walmart fan, but Walmart believes in passing on, you know, savings to make, save money, live better, to pass on to the customer. So, you know, that cost advantage of buying, I've gone back to buying at walmart.com a lot for home stuff, right? You know, Cheerios are Cheerios. Like, it doesn't matter. You know, you know, people have their own things like, oh, I would never buy blank from Walmart. Like, the reality is, like, if you're going to buy Kraft macaroni and cheese, you're going to buy, or Annie's macaroni and cheese, which they have both, or you're going to buy Downy paper towels, you're going to buy whatever it might be. Like, it's the same paper towel, it's the same whatever it might be. And if they can make it easier for me to buy it, like, more power to them.
Are there things from being in an organization of 1.5 million that make sense at Rothy's, you know, with your team today of what, 50 plus people, or how many people are 60 people at Rothy's? Like, is there anything that you bring back from those days into the company?
Well, I think servant leadership lives no matter where you are. Nobody wants to be in a place where egos drive decision-making. I think that I carry with me more than, you know, that I'll never leave of, you know, praise rolls uphill and praise rolls downhill and blame goes uphill. Like, it's my job if something's gone wrong. It means I haven't built the team the right way or we haven't gotten the right resources that we need. I think one of the other parts I loved about Walmart was sort of a willingness to go back and do, they used to call it correction of errors, the COE, after everything launches, of like, what did we learn from this and what are we going to do differently next time? And that's a very healthy way of thinking about businesses. So as we, you know, finish holiday, like, go back and look at, like, let's do a retrospective of what worked, what didn't work, so that next time we don't make the same mistakes again. Because it's good to make mistakes. I mean, honestly, like, it doesn't matter whether you're Fortune 1 or you're little like Rothy's, like, we're going to make mistakes and that's part of how you learn, but as long as you learn from them and don't repeat them.
What are some of the things that you learned from past year at Rothy's that you're trying to avoid for the next time around?
Roth has this analogy I love of when you're growing a company, you're trying to bring all the dimmer switches up at once.
Okay.
and I think it's like, you know, whether the dimmer switch is supply or demand or customer service or marketing, like, it's hard. And so I think we've shot ourselves in the foot several times on, you know, when I first started in 2017, our tracking links didn't work at Christmas or at holiday. So, like, not surprisingly, like, you know, your customer service calls go up because people are really like, where's my package? So stuff like that, you know, don't ever want to repeat mistakes are going to happen, but like not over holiday and not,
so
you know, how do you get smarter about like just sort of institutionalizing some of those things to try and get ahead of like, okay, we know at holiday people are going to be very eager to know where the packages are. What are we going to do to make sure that we're in front of it?
I'm trying to kind of think about the analogy of the dimmer switches, and like, I'm not sure if I'm reading it as, you know, you have to elevate your weaknesses and like kind of get the right, like, if you have things that are really strong, you have to elevate the things that are low and bring them to the right level? Or is it more of a ratio question where you're trying to like, you've got these like six things and you're trying to balance them? Like, what's the right metaphor there?
I think I was doing more of the latter of, I think for the most part, we've been supply constrained because we own our own factory. And so the question we've always faced is how fast can we grow the factory? And then knowing what supply you have, what demand do you want? Like, you know, how fast can you grow marketing? And, you know, therefore, like, if you have X number of, you know, calls per order, how fast do you grow your customer service team? Like, that's more of the ratio I was thinking about. But I like that idea. Like, as I think about building teams, I think about how do you offset the things that either you're not good at or that are draining for you versus the things that, you know, you love to do, and how do you do more of those or that you're really good at? And so I think maybe there's a macro view of that too, right? Which is, how do you recognize the weaknesses that you have and fill those as quickly as you can versus, you know, being really great at one thing?
Yeah, that's an interesting, my co-founder talks about like a lot of things, especially in startups, are in a teenager phase. And like a teenager is often a person who is really good at some things and really bad at other things. And sometimes that's okay. Like, and you have to be able to decide, are you going to try and work on your weaknesses or are you going to focus on your strengths? And that can be a difficult decision to make. Is that something that you faced with Rothy's or in other startups?
Oh yeah. I think all of, I mean, you know, ultimately you want to wake up every day and want to go to work and do your job. And there are parts of your job you're not going to love. And like, how do you do less of those? And you know, one thing, like we just put SAP in.
Oh, wow.
And SAP is, it's an exhausting, like, and we have this woman, Gretchen, who loves SAP and she loves every part of it. I'm so thankful for Gretchen. Like, you know,
we got to have people who have love ERPs. Right? I mean, like, if you don't have
Gretchen,
someone,
right? Yeah. Like, you know, so if I think about like, you know, she loves that job and it makes her happy and it's like, would be draining and awful for me.
Yeah.
But thank God for Gretchen. And she's like, you know, been fantastic in making sure that it's come up cleanly. And Gretchen would be miserable doing my job probably too, right? So, you know, there's like, how do you find those, right? How do you find the Gretchens of the world?
I want to talk a little bit about some of the initiatives you have going on at Rothy's right now. You alluded to this when you talked about China, but what's going on with Rothy's in China?
So I guess there's two sides to that one. So first of all, we own our own factory. So we have a factory in Dongguan, which is in sort of the southern part of China with 450 employees.
That's crazy.
I think it was 120 when I started. So it has grown dramatically.
Impressive.
We've been there for, well, Roth has been there for 4.5 years. We've owned the same factory since, you know, 2016. And the same factory manager has actually been running it, the same head of product development. So he's like, you know, we've kept the same team and just continue to build around them. Spending so much time there, you realize that she's the same woman, whether she's here or there. And so we launched a Shanghai office in June or July of last year. So we launched WeChat selling early this year. We'll launch on Tmall later this quarter. Because I think, you know, it's not a typical thing, I don't think, for a U.S. startup to look at China as their second market.
No,
but
for
it's,
sure.
But it's very much part of kind of who we are as a company, that we've spent so much time there and we're comfortable that it's going to be a long time to build that business. The Chinese business is very different than, you know, there is no Facebook, there is no Google. There is, you know, it's you have to start. You start from scratch, but if you start with a beautiful product that is meeting a need of a, you know, that customer, then there's an interesting opportunity.
And I know that for many companies, I mean, you mentioned Facebook, the government there is like, you know, holds the, I don't know what the analogy, the knobs of it are very tightly controlled. Has that affected you in any way, or was it easier for you because you had a Chinese presence already?
We have we're a wholly owned foreign entity in China. So the Chinese government, you know, we get rebates back for exports. Like, you know, they look at us as a Chinese company there. We pay our employees well above wages, you know, prevailing wages. We pay all of the benefits. Like, so we are a great employer from the Chinese government's perspective. And I think that's where you start is like, are you doing a good thing for, and are you building up the economy there, which we are. And we're doing a great job for the U.S. economy as well. Like, I think there's probably a lot of politics around China that are challenging. If I ran a software company, I might look at it differently because there's a technology question, I think, that we don't have to worry about in the same way.
Well, that brings up a good point. I just like, practically, how does it work? Do you have a separate, you said WeChat, but is there like a e-commerce, are you using Shopify or whatever in China? I don't even know how it works.
No, it's all built on WeChat and going to be built on Tmall. Like, you know, the world there is controlled by Tencent and Alibaba. Mm-hmm. And like, it's the same concept is the same for that, you know, Amazon, Apple, Google, Facebook here control, you know, most of e-commerce, and the same thing is there. It's just different players.
But mobile is so much more important.
Mobile. So I think, and I'm probably a little wrong on this, but I think the average Chinese is spending 6 hours a day on WeChat.
Wow.
WeChat is Instagram. It is Amazon. It is where you buy your bus tickets. It is how you pay for most things in stores. It is, so it's like PayPal. It's even hard, I think, for Americans to understand what it is, because it's also the national identity card, right? Like it is like the security on it's incredible. Like, you know, it is an amazing thing, but like, this is who you are and it's all part of your WeChat and here's who I am. And on Tmall, it's a similar view of, you know, there's like one place to go shopping.
And this for you is an initiative you started at the end of last year. Mm-hmm. And so what's the discovery path for someone to learn about Rothy's in China?
You know, I think it looks a lot like here, but just different names. So their influencers there, they call KOLs, like key online leaders. So it's KOLs, it's press, it's building pop-ups, it's, you know, building presence on WeChat and on Tmall. So it's the same story, different verse of, you know, the same story.
Is there anything that from what you've done here in the U.S. you can bring to China and have an advantage over other Chinese companies?
Well, I think the fact that we're American actually helps us to some degree, right?
Just from a brand perspective,
it's a well-respected American company, and that helps. We have all of our assets are the same, right? So it's the same shoe. Yeah. We're not making a shoe for China that's different than a shoe for America. It's the same shoe. So all the same models we use here, the same photography. We've got an incredible advantage that way of being able to share all the creative. Obviously, you translate the words to Chinese versus English, but it's the same creative. It's the same shoe. And I think that matters a lot in trying to make sure that you're not sort of adding on extra layers of work. It's the same work and just reapplying it.
Is the reverse, is there anything you learned from being in China that you're like, maybe we should try this here in the U.S.?
I wish I could show you on a podcast. I could show you our WeChat store. It's so cool.
What does that mean for the listeners?
To buy Rothy's on WeChat is because WeChat never was a desktop to start with. It's only mobile. Mm-hmm. And so the entire user experience on WeChat's different. And so it is the entire experience of like how you navigate through. I would love to figure out how we do it in the U.S. because it's mobile first in a way. Like, you know, we talk about mobile first, but it's very different when it's only mobile. Like there is no desktop WeChat. I don't think you can do it. I'm sure maybe you can, but like everything that they're doing is like, how do you do it with a couple swipes? So I think, we can learn a lot from, you know, what does the UX look like? How do I think about that? You know, Chinese expectations of logistics are crazy. So if you live in Shanghai or Beijing, they expect same day or next day at slowest. Mm-hmm. It costs a dollar for us to ship a shoe from Dongguan to Shanghai overnight.
And is the price lower there, or how does it work?
Same price.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's crazy. So what does success look like? Is this for you an experiment and you're just like, let's see if this works, or is this a real initiative and you are just trying to figure out like, how do we actually get it, you know, to be on par or as big or bigger than what we're doing in the U.S.?
Michelle, the woman who runs it for us in Shanghai, and I have a bet over when they're going to pass us. Like, it's going to be a big business.
It's going to happen.
This is an experiment. It'll be a big business. I think the question is, like, how long will it take? The Chinese e-commerce market overall is 2.5 times the size of the U.S. e-commerce market. It's a huge market.
And do you feel emboldened by it to go into Indonesia or other places that are, you know, Southeast Asia, where there's so much growth happening? Or are you like, you know, should we go to the UK or Europe or somewhere? Or how do you feel about that?
I think China is hard enough to do on its own. I don't know how much benefit you get to go to Indonesia from China. Like, so I think there's a probably yes and. I'd rather see us go to England first, second, third, a third. So right now you can only buy Rothy's in the US. We're going to start to ship to China, ship to Canada, excuse me, next month. We'll ship to English speaking countries outside the US next, and then the rest of Europe. Which is silly. Like, you know, it's like, it's silly. You know, when the Duchess wore our shoe, so that Meghan Markle wore our shoe the day she announced she was pregnant when she was on tour in Australia. And our Australian and English, like, traffic came, like, you know, through the roof.
Right.
And we couldn't do anything with it. And it's really frustrating. Mm. And again, I think she's the same woman, whether it's Shanghai or London, she's the same woman. So I think there's demand there. And I think in some ways, the demand in Europe may be even higher than the US because they care about sustainability in a different way. I think hopefully, you know, like if you look at kind of the broader environmental kind of priorities the governments have made in Europe, it's higher than it is here. So I think it's the same product for her there as is here. And then it's just the question for us again, maybe the dimmer switches of how do I bring them up at somewhat of the same pace?
So, you know, when you're looking to expand and grow the business, obviously one route you can go is we're going to stay in the US and we're just going to expand our product line and try to make more from our existing base of customers. I mean, you're doing that to some extent, but it seems like you're more aggressively pursuing the path of going international. Is that, do you feel like too many brands in the DTC world or e-commerce world in the US are not thinking enough about international and thinking too much about, you know, how can we expand our product line?
Yeah, I think it probably goes back to the earlier conversation of like how fast do you grow revenue versus profit and where do you want to focus? And I think, you know, this old an adage, I think it came from Andreessen Horowitz of startups never starve, they just drown. Mm. You have to make you're never short of the next thing you could be working on. So what are the priorities and how do you want to focus on them? And I think for us, we're less than 10% share of our target customer in the United States. So we have more than enough to focus on the United States first and foremost. Of, you know, once she tries a shoe on, she falls in love with it. And, you know, once you own one, you own five, right? So there's that full stop. We don't have to go anywhere else. And then I think she is the same woman. And we have, you know, sort of all this organic demand from people who are like, this would be amazing in Canada, England, Germany, whatever it may be. I think if we can do it in a way that is thoughtful, would work well for us. Like I'd like, you know, I also don't want to see that we put pressure on ourselves that Europe has to be twice the size of the United States by X time or China has to be, you know, let's see where it goes organically as much as we can go. You know, half of our traffic right now is still word of mouth in the United States and building that just takes time.
This reminds me of, and I'm going to totally butcher the quotes. I'm not even going to try, but Andy Warhol had like this amazing quote about Coca-Cola where what he thought was inspiring and amazing and very American about Coca-Cola is that everyone has the same Coca-Cola. You go to the middle of Africa and you can get a Coca-Cola, any country, you know, South America. I've always been fascinated by that kind of like approach where you come up with a product so great that like every, you know, it works for everyone. Do you think of Rothy's of like as a Coca-Cola type of product?
The only distinction I might make is whether you do that wholesale or direct to consumer. Because part of what made that was all, you know, Coca-Cola was built on distribution models of other people selling their product for them. I know every woman who's bought a pair of Rothy's to date. And I think...
not exactly literally, but almost. You can find out.
I know. I know who I've shipped it to, whether it's been resold on Poshmark or eBay, like more power to them. But, you know, for the most part, like we've built that relationship with a customer that I love. And with wholesale, you lose that, right? With wholesale, you get maybe rough over-the-counter numbers and sort of broad generalizations of who it is that's buying your product. I'm not sure for some markets, but what you might have to do that. Like if you're going to go into the Middle East, I don't think you can build it on your own. I don't know. I mean, we're trying it in China. Like I think most people might argue you can't do China on your own either. And I guess that's going to be the question for us is how, what part goes, like how fast do you want that to be ubiquitous? What does that look like? Does that need to be, you know, how long is it till you get to Africa? Like, it's hard to imagine like, you know, what this looks like in Africa.
Yeah. You talked about kind of the patents and all of the technology at the very beginning that's been put into this. Something that I was asking you before the show is like, people are going to copy you. People are going to try and replicate this, like especially in a world where in China, things are so, the way they think about trademarks and copyright is a little bit different. I know that this is something that at Rothy's, like you deal with a lot of footwear, you know, Yeezys and everything has to deal with this issue. How do you deal with that? How big of a problem is it for you? Or is it something, does it keep you up at night at all?
Probably no. For the most part, we are actively going after every fake that we find. The good news about a brand like ours is our customers are so loyal and so they send them to us. Like, so it's not like, you know, these things go unknown. I think, ironically, when we're launching in Tmall, one of the things that Alibaba is looking at is like, I'm sorry, one of the things they're looking at is like how many fakes there are on Alibaba. It gives you a sense of like how big the brand is, whether someone's willing to invest in fakes, which is kind of funny. You know, if you search on Amazon for Rothy's, you'll find a Skechers shoe. It's not the same shoe. It's not comfortable in the same, like, you know, it's not made the same way. It's not comfortable. And I guess it's, you know, it's not the same as like a fake Louis Vuitton or a fake Yeezy. They're going to exist in the world and people are going to copy them. But I think you just have to keep focusing on, like, we're going to continue to focus on making the best shoe we can and make sure that we're doing everything we can to protect our patents.
Well, there's copycats and then there's counterfeits. Right. I mean, Amazon, and this is something that just is, it's continually, I'm keeping an eye on it because it's happening to even the biggest brands, you know, Apple and many other brands are having like counterfeit products being submitted into Amazon mm-hmm. inventory and they can't control that. You're not selling on Amazon. And so anyone who's, you know, Amazon is one of the biggest search engines in the world. Mm-hmm. And people, when they want a pair of Rothy's, many of them maybe are just going up to Amazon and they don't see you there. They see this other brand. What's your take on that? Do you just feel like it's, you just have to hold on to that core, you know, customer relationship, and that's you're gonna die on that hill? Or how do you feel about, you know, all those people who are searching Rothy's and finding something else on Amazon?
It's not a great brand experience on Amazon to mm-hmm. explore. You know, a friend of mine ran the Nest store for Google before those two separated. Levi's, same thing, you know, controlling the buy button, controlling fakes for Levi's has been useful there, but it's always a challenge. I think, you know, the marketplace is going to continue to be a challenge for anybody there. I think for the most part, and I may change my mind, I'll reserve that, like maybe in 3 years, things are different.
Yeah.
We have so much growth in front of us with what we can do on our own. I don't want to lose that brand control.
Yeah. Makes sense.
Maybe I'm wrong.
No, I think, you know, we on the podcast, we've had people go every different direction on this. And, you know, I don't know what the right answer is. I don't think there is a right answer. I think it kind of depends on the brand. It depends on what you value ultimately. If user experience is extremely important to you and having that end-to-end control is extremely important to you, then it doesn't make sense. Like, yeah, Amazon is not a fun place to browse. It's like, It reminds me of like you're piloting like a 747. Like they've added functionality so gradually that we've gotten used to it. But if you were to be like a brand new person and went to Amazon for the first time, it's so confusing.
Well, and how many promoted products there are? Like it is a zoo of promoted products where it's hard to even figure out what real is mm-hmm. and what the value of a brand is. I think the worst, you know, beauty is a really tough market. Like if you look up something like a vitamin C serum, you probably have 1,000 response. Like,
right.
God knows what's actually in that bottle.
Right.
Like, you know, I don't know how you,
and
you know,
the reviews are now everything, you know, half the reviews are fake. It's like, how do you trust anything?
Yeah. It's a challenge.
Yeah.
That's where brand matters. It's hard to build a brand there.
Mm. Tell me about the kids shoe. Mm-hmm. When did you launch that?
So we launched a girls loafer last July. And that was sort of the mommy and me view of, we launched the women's loafer originally in March and then kind of relaunched it in May. And that was a, like, you know, my daughter's asking for these, she wants her own version. And then in March we launched the kids sneaker. So we launched the adult sneaker, the women's sneaker in September. And, it's been such a fun, kids products are so fun. They are, you know, the sort of the mommy and me is part of it, but like with the sneaker, we've had flames and we have a camo print made from, you know, one of the office dogs.
Wow.
We have, you know, a camo print made from octopus, like these things that are just, you can play with kids product in a different way than you can play with women's. That's really fun. And washability matters to a mom. You know, a lot of us are moms in the office. Like, you know, having a shoe that you can, you know, kids are so hard on their shoes. And these shoes are pretty durable, but they're not indestructible. Like my son used to use his shoe as a brake on his scooter. It's not going to be a good brake. But it's you know, you can wash them. And kids' feet are smelly. Like there's all these things that like, as a parent, you're like, oh, let me just get, you know. So it's been fun for us to you know, to get a chance to play in that market.
But this is a unisex shoe. And so what does that mean? When the boys who are wearing Rothy's grow up, are they going to have boys' shoes too? What's the plan there?
No, I think our brand is very much about that same woman. Like the Rothy's brand is for her. When and if we do men's, it would be a different, it's a different fit for one. Like I want to make sure like women's feet are narrower than men's feet. It would be a different fit. There are men in our office who are wearing this shoe. You know, a woman, we do half sizes from 5 to 12. So a man's 10 is a woman's 12. Like it's wearable and a lot of men are wearing it. It's not something we're marketing. It's a great shoe.
The feet are not that different. Like physically, right?
Yeah, but true, but men's feet are wider. This because of the fit of the sneaker, so if you have a narrow foot, it fits you great. If you have a wide foot, it would be uncomfortable. You would rub your pinky toe.
I'll have you take a look at my, okay, my feet and let me know if I can wear the sneakers.
The other thing I've learned about shoe fit is it's so subjective. So even though you could measure someone's foot and you would say you are a 10.
Some people like it tighter.
Yeah, like some people love their laces tied really tight. Like you can like watch, like they're going to go running and they have like, you know, they're pulling really hard and some people really don't want them tight at all. Like there's a subjective side to fit of like how close do you want it and how comfortable are you? Mm. Like, you know, you're going to worry it's going to flop off your heel.
You have this incredible technology. What else do you see in the future for it in terms of other knit type of products or things that would work for your consumer?
There's a land of opportunity there.
Uh-huh. Very secretive, I see.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of R&D. We're spending time on both what are other products, what are other materials that you can knit. You know, we launched our products with like the, right? So it's like the point. So it's always be the same point. Like we don't need to come up with a new style every season. It's the same. You know, we can continue to change out colors, but it's always going to be the same point. You'll fall in love with it. And we'll do a couple products well. I think there are other items in her closet that are those that would be interesting to play with.
When you think about growing, and we're in this like mode right now where direct to consumer is just like, I think people have every take under the sun. They're like, it's going down, it's over. We're, you know, there's too many of them. Some people are like, it's just the beginning. You know, only, you know, a small percentage of stuff is being sold online still. We have so much to grow. What's your level of like optimism on, you know, what the next 5 to 10 years look like for direct to consumer and e-commerce in general?
It's such a broad question. I think it depends on the product, probably. From a overall perspective, I think I'd say those who know the customer and can get that feedback and make their product better are going to be better off than those that are selling as a retailer. I think there's an advantage to being a direct consumer company and getting the, you know, fast feedback of what's working, what's not working, and knowing who your customer is. Unit economics of some products are hard, right? So selling a $5 item is hard to manage how the economics are going to work well unless it's a subscription. And do I really, you know, maybe that is better off as wholesale. Maybe those are better off in a store. So there may be changes, like as you think about just sort of from an overall macro perspective, like do you have enough money to be able to invest the right brand building marketing dollars as well as the logistics to build a company? The beauty I think that we live in is in a land of Shopify and 3PLs, like you don't have to build these things yourself. I think, you know, in 2008 at ModCloth, we were building it all from scratch. That doesn't exist anymore, which is,
yeah,
takes a huge amount of pressure off. I think the question, I think it's straightforward to get a company to like 30 or 50 million. I think the question is like, how do you get it to be a billion? And like, what does that look like? And how fast does that happen? That I think we all have some room to get to.
Yeah. And $1 billion valuation is different than
$1 billion revenue.
Dollar revenue. Yeah. And we haven't seen that many of those. We're, you know, we're a generation, second generation now, you know, maybe the Warby Parkers of the world were kind of kicking off some of the concepts of DTC. And now, you know, we see a second, third wave of that. Mm-hmm. What does a $1 billion DTC company look like?
So from a billion in revenue, I think it has to be global. I think it has to be more than one category. And then I think it probably depends on like what, you know, what the unit economics look like, right? And you have to sell, you know, a million of something at $100, or you're going to, you know, like there's sort of the math of like, what is that going to take of, you know, what's the math? A Casper mattress economics look quite different than a Glossier, than a Rothy's. But I think all of us have a potential of what that growth looks like. I think we're still behind, say, a Glossier. I think Glossier is slightly larger than us in revenue. And it's interesting to see them go into color cosmetics. Like, you know, sort of like all of us, I think you're like, okay, so I'm going to start as this and I'm going to build a following of people that know and love my brand. And then how do I continue to expand share of wallet? And I think there's a trust built with consumers when you've built a brand that's direct to consumer that hopefully continues to allow you and you know, that option to go after more of whatever they're spending their money on.
I want to wrap up here, but I saw something when I was doing some background on you that you were working with the Wirecutter for a little bit. Mm-hmm. What I love that site. I love you know, they've obviously been acquired now by the New York Times, but it still seems just as great as it's been. It's just expanded into a lot of areas. What's your relationship with Wirecutter? What are you helping them with?
So I spent I spent 2 years on an advisory committee board working with David and David Perpich, who is the CEO there, and the New York Times team. It is a very much more modern Consumer Reports, I think, you know, of like kind of how do you think about what, you know, I can read, here's the headline and then here's the 1,000 words that go beneath it of like, I want to dig deep into like why porcelain tabletop items or why those headphones are the most important, you know, right. what's important to you. And I think consumers, there's a huge demand for that kind of clarity and, you know, view of, you know, the editorial there that I love. And I think it's an interesting question for the New York Times of as they continue to want to build a long lasting, you know, they're 150 plus year old company. Like, how do I build a long lasting business? And I think that business model has changed pretty dramatically. And so it's been a fun opportunity for me to get to know the Times better and then to really help them think about from an e-commerce perspective, where can Wirecutter go?
That makes sense.
Yeah. It's an interesting business.
Well, we're speaking again about our efforts around Earth Day. We launched a big news section of the Lumi website where people can understand more of the vocabulary around sustainability and how it relates to packaging. And Wirecutter is a constant reference for us because we want to be impartial, and sustainability is like such a sensitive and like the words that exist out there mean different things to different people, and it's very partisan in certain ways among people who care about sustainability. So we wanted to find ways to be, you know, there's a section that we love on the Wirecutter, which is like, why should you trust us? Mm-hmm. And I always think about that, and we want to approach it from a very scientific lens and try to be like agnostic about things. And I think they do a really great job with that. And that's so convincing when you can have like the authority to explain something from the perspective of like, well, here are the downsides of all the things, and here's all the research that we did. Don't just like trust us. Like, here's why you should trust us. And I, in, you know, in a environment of like fake news or whatever you want to, you know, like the amount of information that's out there on the web, it's refreshing to see like people actually do the work, and it makes sense for it to be at the New York Times, which is like a journalistic institution.
Well, I think we all have friends that you would trust more for this than that, right? Of like, you know, the writers and the, that Brian started with, and sort of the whole ethos there of like, the guy who loves headphones is going to spend a lot of time talking about how much he loves headphones. And you can read 27 different ways on why this headphone is the best headphone. And like, but then you trust them from the top line paragraph of like, okay, good three you should go after. Cause a lot of times I read them and I'm like, okay, I'm gonna stop here. And sometimes like, I just love digging in because someone who really loves headphones, like it's kind of cool to learn, like, why does he love them? What's important to him about them?
Yeah.
And I think the same could be true for you as you think about sustainability. There's maybe some partisan part to it. I think the science is hard, right? Of like, well, like, you know, there was a story that came out last week about how bad canvas bags are.
Yeah.
Right. That, you know,
the maybe, trade-offs,
you
know, the are trade-offs, always right?
There's no obvious, like, of course it has to be X, you know, is it a nylon bag that you need then? Is, you
know, it's like, it's always the more you know, the less you know. It's a very, exactly. It's very, it just gets more complicated the more you look into it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it sounds like they're thinking a lot about, e-commerce, and that makes sense, and it probably makes sense why they have you involved in thinking about that.
It's been fun.
Is there anything you want to point people to if people want to learn more about Rothy's, get more of your like incredible insights? Where should we send people?
Well, obviously there's rothys.com, and then all of our social following. I think we've got a pretty active Instagram feed and copy that, you know, I love to watch and read. That our stories every day are always interesting. I think you know, for me personally, like I post on LinkedIn occasionally. I'm not super avid, but enough that like, you know, here's things that are important to me and why.
What do you need help with? How, if you're, are you looking for roles at the company? Are you, how can the people help?
We're always hiring. I think, you know, obviously our careers page has everything that's currently available. If there's other things that aren't there that you think you'd be great at, like we're always, you know, you never know. Like, you know, when you were asking me, like, you know, was this job posted? Like my job wasn't posted. You know?
Yeah.
It's not like you go and you post a lot of these jobs. We are, you know, actively always growing our marketing team and growing kind of, every, you know, again, to my difference, which is like every sector has to come up a little bit at a time at the right
time. I feel like I need a photo of you, like, because this is an audio medium, but just for the people at home, imagine a row of dimmer switches and us moving up and down. Yeah. Cool. Well, thank you so much, Carrie. It was great to have you.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Ooh, one last thing before we go. I'm talking to you at home. What's your favorite brand these days? Is there something that you think is really well made? Or maybe someone that you'd love for me to talk to? Send us a tweet. We are at Lumi, L-U-M-I, on Twitter. We're making this show for you, so tell us what you want to hear, and we'll make it happen. Thanks. See you next time.